This is the Sailing Podcast with David and Karina Anderson, episode number 68. We would love you to support us on Patreon. Visit www.patreon.com/sailing. Hello again, it's David Anderson here, and thank you for joining me for the 68th episode of the Sailing Podcast. Today's conversation is with Richard Hudson. Now, he's circumnavigated the Americas in his schooner, Isuma, and we hear about why Richard chose the Damien II design, and also about the perils of having to purchase a yacht sight unseen, because the yacht was for sale in France while Richard was in New York. Now, we only spoke about a fraction of Richard's sailing, and there really are some other interesting stories on his website, which is isuma.com, including his account of being rolled over in his former yacht, Orbit 2, in a Force 9 storm 300 miles south of Iceland. Now, if you download the Sailing Podcast app from the iTunes or Google Play Store, you'll find not only the podcast, but a bonus PDF guide, which is written by Richard about sailing small schooners. Now, I do mention it during the interview, and Richard was kind enough to let me share it as a PDF bonus to this episode. So if you haven't got the app on your phone, just search for the Sailing Podcast in iTunes or Google Play, and you know, Google Play is perfect if you've got an Android phone. Now, there's an interesting thread which has developed over the past three episodes. One was with Lewis of Alaska Adventure Sailing, there was Ross and Topher from Chasing Bubbles, and now Richard sailing Isuma, and all of them have taken huge trips, but using crew that they sourced along the way. It just goes to show there's plenty of opportunities to gain some valuable experience by looking on sites like findacrew.net, which is the one Richard used for finding crew for his travels. And don't forget, way back in the time machine, I talked to Kylie from Find a Crew. That was all the way back in episode 3. So I'll pop a link to that one in the show notes, along with links to Richard's site, which is isuma.com, and I'll put all of that at thesailingpodcast.com/68. And now, here's the interview. Well, hi, Richard. Welcome to the Sailing Podcast. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you, David.
I know. Thank you for sort of giving me some of your time. I was looking at a map of some of the adventures that you've had, and it looked just amazing to see all the places you go. When I start my interviews with people, it's always nice to go back and hear a little bit of what their sailing history is. And an interesting thing, when I looked at your sailing history on your blog, somewhere I saw a mention that it also goes back a couple of generations, and you have a link to the Shackleton expedition.
My great uncle, my father's uncle, was the navigator on Shackleton's Antarctic expedition. Yeah, that's my link to that.
That's amazing. What was his name?
His name was Hubert Hudson, and he was a Royal Navy officer, and who unfortunately died in the Second World War. So I've never actually met him, but he was the navigating officer on the Endurance.
Wow.
HMS Endurance.
That's an amazing story, and I know Shackleton's a favorite character of one of the other guests I've had on a couple of times, which is Matt Rutherford. I enjoyed the Shackleton story. I saw recently they'd done a couple of Australians had gone and redone the Shackleton, the sort of epic part of the journey. Did you catch that? It was a guy called Tim Jarvis had put together a reenactment.
I missed that. I know there's been several attempts, but I missed that one.
Yeah.
Were they successful in doing it?
Yeah, I think so. It was on Australian TV at some stage, but I'll have to find you a link to that, and I'll send it through to you. But you've also been, like I was saying, I mean, you've got this history of people being on expeditions, but you've been to Antarctica yourself. Is that correct?
That's correct. I was in Antarctica in January, though with much nicer conditions.
Wow, just January.
Much less demanding conditions.
You were down in January this year?
Yeah, January 2016, yeah.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. You must have a pretty interesting boat. I had a little look at it. I mean, you've got to have something sort of purpose-built to be going down into climates like that. I looked it up. The boat is called Isuma. And actually, I'll just mention now also your website's isuma.com. Can you tell me a little bit about the boat? And that might then let us lead into the travels that you've had in Isuma. Am I saying it right?
Yeah, Isuma, yep. The boat is Damien II design, which is a French design, built originally for Jérôme Ponce. And it was designed for Antarctica. It's heavily built of steel, and all the ballast is in a lifting keel. The idea with that is that, for one, you can get into a shallow place to avoid a storm, but also if the ice catches you, you can raise the centerboard, and there's less for the ice to grab you, so you're more likely to be popped up than crushed by the ice. And there are several, I think there were 25 of these boats built. I'm not entirely sure on that. They were built by Meta in France for owner completion. And I'm the third owner of this boat. The second owner finished her off and sailed her about 50,000 miles and then sold her to me. He took her back to France and sold her to me. And I'd been looking for one of these for a few years. I was really interested in the design. I'd heard about this design. I was very interested in it. I thought it was just absolutely the right kind of boat for the high latitude stuff that I wanted to do. I had owned two steel cruising boats before this, so I was quite happy with a steel boat. And so finally I found one for sale on the internet, and I was very concerned that if I didn't buy it, someone else would. And at the time, I was living in New York, I was working there, and my Canadian passport had expired. And it was a bad year for the passport to expire because it ended up taking 10 months to get a renewal. So I'm sitting there thinking, wow, you know, if I don't buy this boat, you know, it's the only one that's come on the market for 3 years. I'm not going to be able to buy it. Someone else will buy it. And, you know, you should never buy a boat without actually looking at it.
Yeah, yeah.
But, on the biggest boat I've ever bought, I ultimately did buy it without ever actually looking at it because I was concerned that I wouldn't be able to buy it. And I thought it was the right design. So I hired a surveyor from the UK to go over to, it was in the north of France and he was in the south of the UK. And I hired him to go over and do a survey and take a lot of pictures and email me pictures. I was very concerned that I might buy a bunch of pictures on the internet without actually buying a boat because, you know, I wanted to make sure that some unrelated party had actually seen this boat and it actually was a real boat, not just pictures. And so, yeah, I did all this remotely and bought the boat without actually seeing it. And 2 weeks after I bought the boat, my passport came through and I was able to actually fly over and see it. But at that point, it was winter. I did fly over and see it. And I think I underestimated the condition it was in. But these things happen. I had sailed across the Atlantic in another boat. So I wasn't, it's a lot to pick up a new boat someplace a used boat to just fly in someplace, pick up a used boat you know nothing about and sail it across an ocean. That was my plan. I wouldn't have tried that if I hadn't already sailed across the Atlantic. So I at least felt comfortable with that. And I'd done two refits on boats before. So I felt comfortable in fixing stuff. But even so, the boat was in pretty bad condition. And my crew and I ended up fixing and sailing and fixing and sailing and fixing and sailing. And we went down the coast of Spain. Well, my first attempt was from the north of France, we were going to go to the Azores. And 3 days out, a few things happened. One, the propane tank and the spare propane tank, which I've been told one was full and one was almost full, and they weighed about the same. Unfortunately, actually, one was empty and the other was almost empty. So we were out of propane. Oh, and man. We'd been confused about the way of filling the water tanks. And we'd gotten confused by water coming out the vent hose and thinking that meant the tank was full, but actually it was water trapped in the vent hose. So we were running short of fresh water. And so for those reasons, we turned around and went to Spain, went to Vigo, Spain, and worked on the boat for a week, got a whole new propane system because they use different bottles in Spain than they do in France. We did the whole thing. Left, had some troubles with the furler, returned after a day, another week working on the boat, and on our third attempt to go to the Azores, the wind wasn't right, so we went to Madeira instead. You know, this is the kind of thing that happens when you're sailing, especially when you have a boat that needs a lot of work. We fixed and sailed, went down to the Canaries, went down to Cape Verde, then went to Argentina and did the first refit there. I went up to Brazil. I was heading farther north. I was trying to do the Northwest Passage then, but I got dengue fever in the north of Brazil. And by the time I got over that, got my strength back from that took quite a while. It's a tough thing to get. But it was too late to go north. And so I went back to Argentina again, did more work on the boat, got her in better shape. And then the next year, single-handed from Buenos Aires up to Brazil and then to New York. And in New York, picked up a crew and we sailed north and went up the coast, went to Greenland. We had some problems in the Labrador Sea. And I wasn't able to make the Northwest Passage that year. We went up to Baffin Island instead, which is northeast Canada. It's west of Greenland. And then went back down in New York. My problems were with the rigging wires, and I bought some new rigging wires and went to Toronto. I was born in Toronto, Canada, and my parents lived there, and I wanted to visit them, so we went up there for the winter. And then the next year, we went down the St. Lawrence River, out the Gulf of St. Lawrence, up the coast of Labrador, over to Greenland, up the coast of West Greenland, and then through the Northwest Passage, across the north of Canada and around Alaska, and then wintered in southeast Alaska, and then went down to Vancouver the next year. And then I stopped sailing for a couple of years and worked. Mm-hmm. And then my second trip on this boat was from Vancouver down to California, then Mexico, then Easter Island, then Chile, down the coast, Patagonian coast of Chile to Ushuaia, Argentina, and then to Antarctica, South Georgia, South Africa, Namibia, and then St. Helena. And from St. Helena, I was single-handed to Norfolk, Virginia, and then came up the coast to New York, where I am right now.
Wow, it always blows my mind when people can summarize such an enormous amount of sailing, you know, in just a few minutes, Richard. I'm looking at the map and I want to share this map with people because it just looks amazing to see the voyages that you did. And you know, it's a circumnavigation of the American continent. And that's just amazing.
Thank you.
And I was looking,
something I wanted to do for a long time.
Yeah. Well, I guess, I mean, you were talking about, I'll go back to the start. You were talking about buying a boat sight unseen, and obviously there's risks with that, but you at least came, I guess, from a background of sailing, and perhaps that gives you a bit of a head start on maybe a first time boat purchaser might be a lot riskier for them to be contemplating buying a boat unseen. But it sounds like you pretty much had done your homework and you knew that you wanted this Damien schooner with the sort of ability to perform in the high latitudes that you were planning to do. I love the swinging keel. There's so many great photos you've got on your site to share. And I was looking at that swinging keel. I'd never seen one on a boat like that before. I mean, I know the Distant Shores guys sail around with a swinging keel, but I think their purpose is so that they can beach the boat on sand, not sort of fight against potential ice things. I read on the side, is this right? It's 4.5 tons of swinging keel?
The lead in the swinging keel is 4.5 tons. And then I'm not sure what the steel weighs. And it also acts as a fuel tank, a 650-liter fuel tank.
Wow.
So it probably weighs closer to 5.5 to 6 tons in total, probably, when it's full.
And how did what's the mechanism then to swing the 5.5 tons? Is it something you can do yourself?
It's a, it's an electric winch going through pulleys that lifts the keel or swings it up. It's a centerboard. It's got a pin. It swings. It doesn't. It's not a dagger board that's driven straight up and down. but yeah, it's an electric winch that swings it up, and I cannot do that by hand. Mm. And if the something was to happen with the electric winch and I could not raise it, then I would have a sailboat with a deep draft. It's 3.2 meters, 10.5 foot draft for sailing, which I love the lifting keel in this boat. It's a fantastic thing because it does let you get into shallow, relatively shallow places, but does keep the weight low enough in the boat that you can actually, that it's still a heavy boat like this still sails. But you must have the thing down and locked. There's a 1-inch diameter pin that goes through it to lock it in place so that if it hits something it or that if you roll over that the centerboard can't come up. And that's absolutely critical to remember to do before you set sail, because otherwise if you caught a gust of wind and heeled over a lot, and then if the centerboard was ever to come up without being locked in place, well, then you'd be dead. You'd be, the boat would roll over, it would not come back up, everyone would die, and that's why all boats are not made this way. It's a great feature, the lifting keel with all the ballast in it, but I totally understand why it's something you have to always be a little concerned about and always aware of to use safely.
And Richard, I hadn't realized you'd done so much sailing solo. You know, Isuma is a schooner, and I did read you've got some information on your website about sailing a schooner, and part of it sort of refers to the advantages of not having so big a sails to sort of deal with. Was that part of the rationale when you were boat shopping? I mean, I think you've had a couple of them, haven't you? Schooners, you seem to love them for that reason, or is there other things?
When I started sailing, it was in dipping lug, schooner rigged, converted lifeboats when I was a kid. And then I worked on a training ship, which is a brigantine, which is basically a schooner with a square sail and a foremast. And so I was quite familiar with schooners. I did own two of them before I bought the Isuma. I really bought a Isuma for the lifting keel. I thought that was what I really wanted out of it. And it happened to come with a schooner rig. The advantage of, as you say, of the schooner rig is, or of a multi-masted rig, is that you break the sails up into smaller pieces. The disadvantage being that they're less efficient that way, but the advantage is that it's less, each sail is smaller in size, so easier to handle, or not so easy to get out of control.
Right. And the solo sailing, is that something you like to do, or has that sort of just come about sort of, because some of the trips, it sounded like when you were telling the story then, it was some of the longer legs you were sailing solo. Was that sort of just a necessity with sort of trying to find crew, or was that something you've planned to do because you enjoy doing it?
That started as a necessity, just because of can't find crew at a particular time. And I'd always preferred sailing with crew, because sailing with good crew. But sometimes, depending on where you are, you may not be able to find crew, and volunteer crew at least. Sometimes it just happens you can't find crew, or you have crew but they get sick or something like that, or you know, some situation comes up and they can't continue. And at that point, you know, if you really need the crew, then you're stuck waiting to find some new crew. Or else you're going to go single-handed. And so I always wanted to make sure my boat was capable of being single-handed, so I made sure to set things up that way. And yeah, then it's my single-handing on this boat tends to be when I can't find crew, I single-hand. I actually came to like it. I really enjoyed my last passage, which was my longest single-handed passage. I'm thinking it's somewhere around 5,800 miles, and it was really a powerful personal experience to be alone at sea that long. I had not expected I would like it that much. I wasn't looking forward to it.
Right.
But it just happened, and I really enjoyed it.
That's interesting. I was looking at that. You know, we were talking about the start of your journey where you started with the boat in France, and then you've sort of sailed. When I look at the map, it's almost like you've sailed diagonally down from, all the way down to Argentina, which just seems like such an unusual path. I mean, I don't know why, but always when I look at people's paths, they tend to go straight across the North Atlantic and end up in the Bahamas or something. What made you sort of island hop through the center of the Atlantic Ocean and end up in Argentina? Was there a connection there, or was that just something that you wanted to do?
That was not entirely planned.
Okay.
My original plan, with the boat was I was trying to negotiate to get 3 months off work to sail my boat that I bought in France back to New York. And I was working for a bank in New York, and this is in 2008, just when all the banks failed. And ultimately, I couldn't get permission to go. And I had already arranged crew, I'd arranged air tickets, I'd sent a whole bunch of stuff over to France. And so I just quit my job and left and went to France. I was still trying to get across, I was trying to leave the 1st of May and to make it across the Atlantic before hurricane season got well underway.
Yeah.
Now, as it turned out, my boat needed an awful lot of work, and we were nowhere close to being able to make that crossing until the hurricane season was really well underway, at which point you don't want to try that. And there was no reason. At that point, it became apparent that I could see what was happening with all the banks failing, and there was no jobs to go back to, so there was no reason for me to hurry back. And I thought it would be better to go do a refit on the boat. And France is a very expensive place to do a refit on a boat.
Yeah.
I thought South Africa would be a great place to do a refit because I thought it's big yachting center, lots of stuff, and they speak English. And so my plan was to go to South Africa. And so we went to get to South Africa, to get around the South Atlantic High, to get to South Africa from the north of Africa, like where Cape Verde is. You basically go down the east coast of South America, or you go on the west side of you go down the west side of the South Atlantic Ocean until you get south of the High, and then you go pretty much straight east across. So that was the plan. Unfortunately, we had enough problems at sea with breakdowns that 800 miles southeast of Rio de Janeiro, I thought that, South Africa is not where I should be going. We should go to Argentina instead. So I originally did not want to go to Argentina for the refit because I didn't speak Spanish.
Yeah.
And I went to Argentina anyway and learned Spanish.
Okay, and what was it like value-wise? I mean, I'm just guessing. I mean, Argentina, to me, wouldn't sound like a particularly expensive place, not if you were comparing it to maybe France or even Australia. Is that a correct assumption, or was it still expensive?
Oh, no, the labor rates are quite low in Argentina. There are other challenges there. The culture is much different, but it's a lot less expensive to do a refit in Argentina. I did a lot of work in Brazil as well. Argentina and Brazil, they're a lot less expensive places to get boat work done than France.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, it was just sort of that. You just sort of got to that point, and it was better to stop there and get the work done than try and continue. Get back to South Africa. So we're talking about, that was about 2008 you picked up the boat. So perhaps it's 2009 by the time you're in Argentina. And I'm just trying to give people an idea of, because I'm thinking about your Northwest, your sail through the Northwest Passage was 2012, I think I wrote down somewhere.
2011.
And Why? How did that come to be on the sort of top of the to-do list for you? Because, I mean, you've gone to buy the boat with the intention of high latitude sailing. Had you just where does that desire come from? I'm asking that because I'm sitting here in a sort of subtropical climate. I can see the photos are beautiful when people sail through the Northwest Passage, and the photos that you take on a sunny day look fantastic. But there is a bit of a downside to it.
Yes, there's a bit of a downside to the Northwest Passage. That's correct. It's a hard way of getting across, of getting between the Atlantic and the Pacific. You never know whether you can do it in one season or not. It entirely depends on the ice situation that year.
Yeah.
And you don't know what that's going to be until mid-August or sometime in August. And August is your month when you're really trying to get through the main part of that. Because come September, you're starting to get the autumn gales settle in, and you've got less hours of daylight. And when you're sailing around ice, if you don't have light to see, you know, you're going to have to slow down or stop. So, yeah, the Northwest Passage is a really difficult way of getting to the Atlantic Pacific. It has some beautiful scenery in places, and it's something I wanted to do for a long time. I lived in northern Canada for 5 years, and I kayaked a few thousand miles through northern Canada and Alaska.
Oh, wow.
And traveled around quite a bit. And it was just always something I wanted to do, the Northwest Passage. And that's why the desire to do it. And it didn't seem like it didn't seem like it was a good time to go back to work. And I thought it was a good time to go through the Northwest Passage. So that was why.
That's
the Northwest
excellent.
Passage. I was interested in getting to the West Coast also, I should say. That was also my goal. I thought it was a place I'd never really sailed much, and I wanted to go there. I heard lots about it.
Right. And so going through the Northwest Passage, how many of you were on the boat for a journey like that?
So I had two crew with me until Kodiak. So through the technical part of the Northwest Passage, I had two crew for the whole time. And then I was single-handed from Kodiak across the Gulf of Alaska, from Kodiak to Yakutat. And then I had another friend come up and join me for the trip through Southeast Alaska. And then most of the way to Vancouver, after the winter, I did that by myself. But the Northwest Passage itself, I had two crew.
Ah, excellent. And So you're based there, you got the boat to Vancouver. I mean, it just sounds like, it just feels like such an understatement to say so little about sailing through the Northwest Passage. I mean, it must have been just so exciting and mixture of storms, and I guess you saw the polar bears and sort of had to plan all that technical sailing through the area. I mean, what were some of the challenges?
Northwest Passage is a lot of, you decide to go, you get yourself far north, and you attempt it, and you find out at that point whether you're likely to get through that year or not. And then you got to decide if you're going to keep going or not. I lucked out. I happened to go through in a record low ice year, but that wasn't something I was expecting. And until you pretty much got to go up to 74 and a half, 75 degrees north, and get yourself in position to go through where the difficult ice sections are of the Northwest Passage, the parts that are the last to break up and that sometimes don't break up. You've got to be up way up north in a position to go through by the time mid to late August comes around, or else you will not be able to make it through. So you can't wait for a good ice year and then go. You have to go and find out if it's a good ice year or not.
Yeah, yeah. So you've got to really plan ahead, don't you? You've got to commit, even though you don't know if it's going to pay off.
That's right. You've got to commit, and you've got to be prepared. You know, you've got to have lots of food. If you have a breakdown, if you slow down, if you get stuck by ice, I mean, the possibility of having to winter over is definitely always there. Hopefully you would be able to get to some community and winter the boat over there. But there are no good places to winter a boat in the Northwest Passage. There are places you can do it. I don't think I'd call any of them really good, desirable places. You'd rather take your boat through and get it somewhere farther south.
Yeah.
So you're always concerned about that. To me, I always had lots of concerns about the Northwest Passage, but not wanting to get stuck and concerns about ice and things like that. It was a fair amount of effort to get through it. There were some nice places to see, but you're also pressed for time because the longer you spend in the Northwest Passage, the later it is when you're getting out of it. And when you're getting out of the Northwest Passage, you're either going into the Bering Sea or you're going into the Labrador Sea, and you're doing it in the autumn with all the autumn gales and less daylight. And both those places are really nasty, really nasty seas. Mm-hmm. You don't really want to be in those places late in the year. They're just rough.
Did you find yourself fairly isolated sailing, or were there other boats around at the time, Richard?
There were other boats that I was aware of through email, and in port you'd meet them, but so much of the time the visibility was poor from fog that you wouldn't really, I don't think I ever actually saw another boat in the Northwest Passage sailing. There were several at the same time, but I'd see them in port. There was a few, but I only saw them in port, never actually saw them sailing.
Right. Well, let's talk about a little bit about the coming down the west coast of the American continent. I can't just say the US. You left the boat in Vancouver, and I guess you had to go and find a job for a little while.
I found a job in Vancouver. So I worked in Vancouver for a couple of years.
Ah, excellent. And then you get sort of saved up, got the boat. Did you have to do any refitting while it was in Vancouver, or was it sort of more a maintenance time?
There was maintenance while I was in Vancouver. And then I actually spent 6 months after I quit my job. I solely worked on my boat for 6 months.
Excellent.
And then left Vancouver in September 2014 on my second trip, which was 2 years long.
And that trip, so, when you left there, new crew, or are you sailing by yourself now?
I had crew. I had different crew at different times. I had between one and three crew. I went to Washington State, California, Mexico, and then Easter Island in Chile. And in Chile, in near Puerto Montt, in Isla Chiloé, I spent the Southern Hemisphere winter there, and then got a crew, and in the spring went down the Patagonian coast to Ushuaia, Argentina. Patagonia was absolutely awesome.
I just love to go there. I mean, I love the stories that come out of that area, and it looks breathtaking. I think it would be an amazing place.
Yeah, it's always rainy and windy. The charts are good in places, not in others, and it's complicated to anchor there because most of the time you have to use shorelines, but some stunningly beautiful places and very remote. There's quite a bit of bureaucracy you have to deal with reporting into the Navy and getting permission on paper and so on and so forth. But it's a really beautiful place, and this untouched wilderness kind of place.
Yeah, no, that would be amazing. Hey, can I go back one step, or maybe two steps in the journey? I'm impressed you stopped at Easter Island, probably not on the paths of many travelers. What was the rationale for going to Easter Island? I mean, it's a fascinating place. Everybody knows the big statues, and my son's he's studying environmental science at the moment, and they were just learning about how the Easter Islanders cut down all their trees and nearly sort of destroyed themselves by doing so. What made you go there to visit?
Well, Easter Island, to get from Mexico to Patagonia, it's because of the southeast trade winds, if you were to go down the coast, you'd be beaten against the southeast trade winds and against the Humboldt Current up the west coast of South America. So if you really like sailing and not motoring, the way to go is to go way offshore, way out where Easter Island is, and try and get yourself around the South Pacific High, and then go east to Patagonia. At that point, Easter Island is on the route. If you're really trying to sail it rather than motor it, trying to sail it without beating to windward forever, yeah. Easter Island's on the route. So it's a great excuse to stop in Easter Island. And Easter Island is a very interesting place, as you mentioned. The reason to go there was primarily that the winds were favorable to take a route that went through Easter Island rather than down the coast of South America.
Right. And what about anchorages and things? I mean, I don't imagine there's a fancy marina at Easter Island. Is there a sheltered place? Because I just don't hear very often of people popping in there.
No, there's no sheltered anchorage. There's a small harbor for boats less than 15 meters. It's quite small, and I think you need local knowledge to get in because you got to go know where the rocks are. What you really have to do is you anchor out of the waves and wind and be prepared to move when those change. So there are several anchorages around Easter Island. There's no harbors, really. There's just anchorages that'll get you away from the swell and the wind. And the interesting thing about the waves in Easter Island is that they usually, at least when I was there, they never seemed to come from the same direction as the wind, because the waves were always generated by some far-off storm.
Right.
And it bore no resemblance to the wind, which is kind of interesting. We just had to keep moving the boat to different anchorages.
Yeah. I imagined it. I just have sort of, after watching like videos of Easter Island, it just looks like it's pretty ferocious and exposed coastlines everywhere. But so you sailed across to Chile, and did you say that you actually wintered somewhere in Chile? Like, did you literally, you didn't leave the boat, you stayed with it and spent a winter down there?
Yeah, I anchored. I spent the winter at anchor, mostly in Castro, which is on a big island called Chiloé. And that's mostly where I spent the winter. I would travel inland off and on during that time, but mostly I was doing maintenance on the boat and occasionally sailing.
Right. So it was just as well, you did have to learn Spanish on the other side when you were doing the boat fit. It would have come in quite handy by the time you got back into Chile. So your Spanish must be quite good by now.
No, I'd like to say my Spanish is quite good. I have to say that my Spanish is still, it's enough to get me by.
Right.
That's all. You don't learn it that fast when you're on a boat because you're kind of isolated. You would learn it faster if you're inland, totally surrounded by you cannot speak anything but Spanish.
Yeah.
Then on your boat, you're kind of on your own little island, so you're not so much forced to always speak Spanish.
Right. And can I ask you more about Antarctica, which is what we started with at the beginning of the conversation? Because you said you were in Patagonia. You sort of dealt with all the bureaucracy of sort of the two different countries. Doesn't the border run down the middle of one of the canals when you're sailing through Patagonia?
Yes, the border between Chile and Argentina does run down the Beagle Canal, yes.
Sorry, my question was going to be then, because going into Antarctica, there's a bit of bureaucracy to get through as well. You would have had to get a permit and permission to sail down there?
That's correct. There's a lot of bureaucracy to get to Antarctica legally. But once you're there, it's a lot of writing to get the permit. But once you're there, you don't have to report in all the time. In Chile, you have to report in every day.
Wow.
Both of those places have extensive paper requirements that you wouldn't expect, especially Antarctica. You wouldn't expect that because kind of just so isolated. But 160 countries have signed the Antarctic Treaty,
Yeah.
And there are significant fines for if you're a citizen of one of those countries, like which most people in the world are, if you don't abide by the terms of them, which it requires getting a permit. And the permits are not really designed for yachts. The permits are designed for big scientific expeditions and things like that.
And so how long did you get to spend actually, you know, on Antarctica or off the offshore of Antarctica? I don't know how you'd describe it. Were you there for very long, or was that restricted by the permit or the weather?
It wasn't restricted. It was not restricted by the permit, because you can ask for whatever time you need. But we only spent the month of January in Antarctica, and then I didn't feel I had the whole. I could have stayed longer, but I wanted to get back to North America before hurricane season. So that was why I only spent a month in Antarctica, and then we went to South Georgia, and then South Africa. South Georgia is absolutely stunning and awesome. It's got its own procedures to go through to get there. And they do charge you.
How did you go for crew, sort of for the Patagonia, Antarctica, like you're saying, South Georgia, and across to South Africa? I mean, some people pay thousands and thousands of dollars to get on a cruise ship and go down to Antarctica. It's such an amazing experience. Like you say, it's fairly restricted, and that sort of makes it expensive for people to holiday there. I think your crew were very lucky, and how did you find them?
I mostly find my crew through findacrew.net, because they've got most crews seem to be on findacrew. So mostly I find my crew that way. Sailing with people you don't know is quite a challenge. It's hard for people who are with the best of intentions, who try to describe themselves to others.
Yeah.
It's hard for one person's description of themselves, you know, and what their goals are and how they are. It's hard for that to translate to someone else and vice versa. So that makes finding crew challenging. The shorter the trip, the easier it is. And you can meet some great people through having them as crew.
But you potentially took people down to Antarctica that did they have like limited knowledge of how the weather was going to be and how potentially seasick they were going to get? I mean, it can be fairly strenuous having long stretches of bad weather. It's physically exhausting, which then leads to it being mentally exhausting. How do you even judge somebody's character unless you can put them into a stress test and see how they hold up?
You can't reliably judge someone's character unless you can do that. Yeah. So you have to, you know, you have to take what you can. I try to describe things how I perceive. I try and describe it as bad as it can get, because I want people to understand that it can get very bad. But you know, it's one thing to describe something in words, to write it in an email, and it's another thing to experience it. I look is the amount of knowledge people have. I mean, it varies, and the amount of experience they have varies. So do some people really understand how rough the weather will be and how much they'll get seasick before coming? No, I would say that not everyone does understand that. Though you try hard to make everyone understand that as much as you can, but it's just not quite possible to do that. So you try as best you can to describe. I try and describe as difficult as it'll be. I try and describe it as difficult as I think it could be.
Yeah, I think you'd be looking for people who
dissuade people who are not serious.
Yeah, I guess you'd be looking for people who've got a fairly adventurous nature, like they don't want to go on it just to go and see the penguins. They do understand that going on something like that is really an expedition in itself, isn't it? It's got the qualities of an expedition where it's hard work, and you've got to sort of pay the price of a bit of discomfort if you want to reap the rewards of seeing things that normal people just don't see every day, I guess.
That's right. Yeah, it's hard work, and it can be more than a bit of discomfort. And you have to have, you know, suitable clothes and all that. You know, it's darn cold.
Yeah, yeah.
It can be very, very uncomfortable.
Tell me about the trip across. You went South Georgia. You've then cut across to South Africa. Did you get to spend time there? Or, like you said before, you were sort of getting a bit pressed for time because you wanted to get back to the east coast of the US and safely home?
I was pressed for time. Everything seems to have taken longer than planned. In South Africa, I spent 3 weeks just fixing stuff on the boat. And then to get north before hurricane season, yeah, there wasn't much time. So I found myself pressed for time. And I did not see much of South Africa. I would have liked to. I would really like to go inland in South Africa and see more of it. Went to Namibia, had two ports in Namibia, and got a chance to go on a safari in Namibia, which was absolutely fantastic.
Excellent.
I'd love to go back inland in Africa and spend some time seeing the inland parts of the southern part of Africa. But that'll have to wait for another time.
Yeah, I'm looking at that map where you've cut across from Namibia all the way to the east coast. It looks like one continuous leg, but I guess I can't see the name of the islands in the middle.
Helena.
You stopped at St. Helena, right? But after that, how long was that leg? How long did that take you? And did you say you did that leg solo at the end of this last trip? So how long was that leg?
That was close to 2 months. It was 50 something days. The reason it was so long was as I got towards North America, towards the US, I was going close to the Bermuda High, and so the winds got really light. And I have a wind vane that mostly steers the boat most of the time. And then when the winds are light, I use sheet to tiller. When the winds are too light for the wind vane, I use sheet to tiller. But when they get really that light, you know, you're talking about 5 knots or so, they're often variable and they sometimes change quickly. And I don't always, sometimes the sheet to tiller isn't enough. And then I don't have an autopilot. So at that point, I can either hand steer or I could motor and hand steer. But if you're single handing, you can't hand steer all that long.
Yeah.
So I would always strive to sail instead of motor. But when the winds are really light, you just don't go very far. So it made for a slow trip. The last third of it was fairly slow.
And was that frustrating for you, or were you by then fairly relaxed, like you said, that you sort of did find that you enjoyed the solo sailing, or were you sitting on the boat sort of dancing a jig and pulling your hair out waiting for the wind to pick up?
Oh no, I was fine with it. I was just paying attention to all the hurricane forecasts, and I was enjoying the time. I was really just enjoying it. I knew that I had to get into port. I wanted to get in to port soon, but you know that the wind wasn't going to make it happen soon. Well, that was not really that was just the way it was. That wasn't a major concern. It was enjoyable.
Excellent.
Passage. It was hard work with a lot of sail changes and all that and the light winds, but it was enjoyable.
Right. And so you sailed the boat back up to New York because New York's home. That's where you are now. And that's where I'm talking. I know you're there now because we had to work out the time zones, but New York's home?
Home is where the boat is. I did live in New York for a long time, but I'm just visiting here right now. I may come back here. I'm not quite sure. Depends where I find a job.
Okay, so the boat's there with you. What's the plan? Are you debating between boat and another trip?
I need to work for a few years and save some money up. And then my next trip, I would like to go back to Labrador and Greenland. I mean, they're both stunningly beautiful places. And neither of them is all that far. If you're on the east coast of North America, neither of them is all that far. It's not like going to going to Antarctica. So yeah, that's my plan, and to spend a summer going to Labrador and Greenland.
Oh, that's awesome, Richard. Like I said at the start, I mean, it's just looking at the map, because I mean, obviously, sailors are we're our own little niche audience of enthusiasm for sailing, and we sort of respect and can appreciate someone like yourself doing such an amazing journey on your boat. How do you find it? You said to me when we were corresponding a little bit, you know, you're going out to dinner with some friends, and so we were sort of planning our times around that. But how do you find it? People who don't understand sailing probably wouldn't understand sort of the enormous journey that you've made. Does that sort of ever strike you? I mean, when people say, oh, what have you been up to the last couple of years? Do you find yourself sort of hesitating to start talking about the enormity of the journey? Do you sort of find yourself downplaying it? Or I don't know, what I'm trying to ask is, you know, do you find it funny that maybe some people don't realize what an enormous trip you've had?
Oh, I just say I've been sailing and judge how much detail I go into based on how much interest and knowledge they seem to have. I mean, people who haven't gone long distance sailing don't understand how much work it is to run a boat, to keep a boat in good maintenance, and just to operate the boat, you know, looking out, planning around the weather and all that stuff, you know, that, you know, you're aware of. Most people don't think of that. They think, you know, you just, it's a relaxing way of life, and you just set the sails, they take you where you want to go, and do you enjoy the sun and the sip a cold beer and yeah, enjoy yourself all the time.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think it's amazing, Richard. Thanks for just running us through, basically, I mean, it's such an enormous trip we've covered in a relatively short time. There's some really good detail on your website. I mentioned it before, isuma.com. I mean, it's obviously, I don't think it's like your number one priority in life, sort of entertaining people on the internet, but you have collected some beautiful photos. I'll put links to your website with the sailing podcast sort of show notes that I do, so people can go and have a look. Some of the stuff that's there, I've seen there's like really good descriptions of your boat and pictures from the previous owner of it out of the water, so people can see the shape of the hull and maybe, you know, how it's been designed to be able to handle the high latitude. You've got links to, I saw some of the other boats that you've had. You've got articles there about sailing a schooner and some of your thoughts about how they handle, and that might be really interesting to people who haven't spent a lot of time on them. Like I've never sailed on one, so I thought it was really interesting to hear about to read about the sail handling and things. I think it's a great resource, Richard. Thanks for putting it out there, and I'd love to share it with people.
Oh, thank you, David.
Thanks for your time. It's been great.
Oh, thanks very much, David. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks, Richard. Talk to you later.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Well, thanks again, Richard. It was great to hear about your travels. I hope we can catch up again after your trip to Greenland. I'm sure that would be an amazing experience as well. Don't forget to download the Sailing Podcast app. Use iTunes or go into the Google Play Store if you've got an Android phone. Just search using the words The Sailing Podcast. I'll try and find some more extras to publish to the app as we catch up with future guests. Speaking of future guests, there's a couple of Aussies just about to pop into Noosa on the Sunshine Coast. It's Michael and Andy Holt. They've just returned from a season cruising the South Pacific in their yacht, Rome. And if you want to check out their YouTube channel, it's Sail Surf Rome. Hopefully I can catch up with them and we can hear about the building of their yacht in Tasmania and some tales from sailing in the South Pacific this season. Well, thanks again for listening. I hope you have a great day and thank you for joining us on our journey. You've been listening to David Crean Anderson of the Sailing Podcast.